Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest Brewing podcast. Well, there can be no doubting the biggest news this week, of course, that is the Brexit deal progress. But we're going to reserve comment on that particular issue until next week. We're in a real coup for the podcast. I can reveal we will be bringing you an exclusive interview with none other than David Davis MP. But today we switch our attention to the UK stock markets, and that is perhaps a welcome break to you all. And we're going to be looking at a handful of companies, doing a relatively deep dive with Man GLG's Henry Dixon. Now, the names covered include IAG, Crest Nicholson and HSBC. But first we cover BATS, and here is our guest's bottom line verdict on the prospects for the company.
This is a company that can delever. And if this is a company that can delever, even in the regulatory landscape we find ourselves in today, then this is a company that I think can correct from its lowest valuation that we've seen in approximately 20 years.
Okay, for some equally direct chatter on the companies mentioned, please keep listening. But first, here are our disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation, which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest Brewin podcast. I'm Ben Guthridge, Head of Fund Research, and today we're going to be talking about UK equities. And on that basis, delighted to welcome the Star Fund Manager of Man GLG, Henry Dixon, manager of their UK income fund and their undervalued assets mandate. Now, this recording is actually coming at the very same time that Theresa May is pitching her deal to the Cabinet. So it'd be very unfair of us to spend any time at all really on Brexit, given that we don't know the outcome of that meeting. And so what we're going to do today is focus on stocks. I think we want to talk about BATS, Crest Nicholson, IAG, so the bond market with HSBC, perhaps. It may be unavoidable to sort of mention Brexit in each of those circumstances, but we shall do our best to sort of focus in on the operations. Henry, thanks very much for taking the time to be here. I know you're a very busy man, so let's start on BATS. I think I've talked enough. There's lots of things to worry about on BATS, but why don't you sort of lay out the bull case, why it's found its way into your portfolio?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think BATS will clearly be, I think, probably a well-held stock across Brewin's. It's been formed part of portfolios for a long, long period of time. I think the interest from our perspective is clearly, you know, where we find ourselves in valuation today. So cheaper than it was in the financial crisis. And you'd probably have to go back to the early 2000s to find this type of valuation opportunity. But we've got to think how we've got here. So I very definitely think there was some overconfidence from BATS. The type of confidence you get when a share price basically goes up, you know, for a number of years in a row. There's an element, I guess, of confidence and maybe sort of exuberance to some extent in the boardroom that means you definitely overextend yourselves. And I think if we look at the Reynolds deal they did last year, it definitely took the balance sheet to a place whereby I think debt got a little bit too high. I think another sort of analogy we give you is Anheuser-Busch with their deal as well. But it's these companies that overextend themselves with big M&A tend to have the first reset in share price terms when if there's any bad news, it doesn't have to be that bad. I think if the balance sheets get too overstretched, then valuation is definitely the lever that gets pulled quite hard to the downside. And that's basically been the first stage. Now, from our perspective, I think the interest that we would sort of show in the shares is because that debt that build-up in debt has caused the valuation to correct quite materially. And from our perspective, we still think the cash flow credentials of BATS definitely are there, and also would say that alongside Imperial Brands as well. And from our perspective, we absolutely love it when companies own up to the fact they have too much leverage and they therefore are determined to pay down leverage. The picture has been further muddied, I think, by regulation.
Certainly this week as well. I mean, it's absolutely an ongoing thing, but this week's been a bit of a challenge.
And clearly, when regulation comes into it, I think we'll be thinking about the cash flow credentials of that company going forward. Those two things go hand in hand. if we think about regulation, again, we have a lot of sort of historical episodes of regulation. It does take a while. I think the latest news we have with regards to menthol, for example, has clearly fed into the sector quite dramatically this week. As you look back at historical episodes, there's definitely quite a bit of a time lag here. So as we look at bats, you know, you'll be looking at it about sort of 20% of half the business, if you like, is going to be exposed to this. But you can clearly point to US peers, for example. I don't think Bats' footprint is hugely different to Altria. Here we have Altria trading at about near 14, 15 times earnings. Today we have Bats on less than 10 times. So there's clearly a big valuation disparity. I think the whole reason really for it is the balance sheet here. And as I go back to the recent results, I think the slight disappointment the market might have had with the recent results, despite the fact that P&L was good, was their debt pay down. But the company's gone into a lot of detail with regards to some of the foreign exchange trends they're seeing in their emerging markets. And as I say, we have a huge amount of confidence this is a company that can delever. And if this is a company that can delever, even in the regulatory landscape we find ourselves in today, then this is a company that I think can correct from its lowest valuation that we've seen in approximately 20 years.
So, just on the regulation, obviously it's very hard to second guess what the FDA are going to do, but I forget his name, but they've got a new guy in, I believe, at the FDA who's sort of got the bit between his teeth, and he's after menthols now, and obviously the Reynolds tie-up, you know, makes that even more of a sort of spurious acquisition, but... How do you manage that situation? And what are clearly the risks are that he sort of follows through on this these ambitions.
Absolutely. So I think if you follow through, you have a huge amount of timeline with regard to this. Could not just become an enactment tomorrow. There would be periods of time. And you look at previous episodes of these types of regulatory changes, and the lag you have is 3 to 5 years, basically. So I'm not saying that's clearly, absolutely, what I would describe in the short to medium term, and clearly will have an impact on valuation. But I think from our perspective as allocators of capital, what you have to think about is the relative valuation in the sector. And as I say, I think there'd be comparables in the space with a similar footprint, and we would look at something like Altria, whereby you're trading at about a 30% discount there.
So if we're looking at Bats versus Altria, you highlight the discount between Bats and Altria. Now, I don't know enough about Altria's business, but my understanding of Bats is that they've diluted their emerging markets exposure through the purchase of Reynolds. And, you know, ostensibly, that's a bad thing, because emerging markets is where all the growth is.
Absolutely. Although, interestingly, I think we've come from a period whereby emerging markets probably hasn't given them the premium in valuation that it would have been historically. I think it's been well documented that EMFX has been under some pressure. The business now today is much more balanced 50-50. As we look at it, therefore, I don't think its footprint is wildly divergent to that of Altria's. Clearly, there are nuances there and clearly there are slight differences. But with regards to valuation, we think the discrepancy is too stark. And the key thing that we would observe, however, is the balance sheet is probably one turn of EBITDA more levered in financial terms than Altria. So from our perspective, the key dynamic going forward is, can this business prove up the cash flow that it failed to do with its last set of results? And should that be forthcoming, we've gone into a lot of detail through the presentations with the company. We very definitely do think that was a situation whereby that was a short-term phenomenon regarding EMFX, definitely some inventory build in some of the channels that we saw in some geographies. And we would have confidence in the cash flow of this business in the next 3 to 6 months. Now, clearly, from our perspective, if that fails to materialise, this will be a situation for us to reappraise the shares. We came into really with this year, as I say, not holding the shares. We've observed a big opportunity on valuation. That's encouraged us to definitely expose ourselves to the shares here. But as I say, we always reserve the right to change our mind. And the key bit of information we now need to see in the next 3 to 6 months is the cash flow from this business, which we are confident will precipitate.
Well, that's a really neat summary. But one last question before we move on. You can't really sort of avoid next gen when you talk about tobacco. And on the cash flow point, I guess there is some concerns that these businesses are sort of throwing money at next gen products when actually, you know, there is a sort of a cap to sort of the growth in that market. Maybe there isn't, but what do you think? Bat's got its strategy right on next gen?
Yeah, I do. I think there have been some frustrating data points, I think, with inventory build, but I think next gen is clearly revenue opportunities. I think they've slightly missed their revenue guard as they set themselves this year. As I say, I think you can legitimately point to a couple of bottlenecks in the supply chain there. I think to dismiss next gen out of hand is very premature indeed. And as I say, I still think next gen offers some opportunities going forward, but key for me in the next 6 months is, if you like, how the old business performs on a cash flow basis. And if that turns up, then I think this is a business that can definitely add PE points because it looks unusually cheap.
And if it pays down its debt with that.
Absolutely
with
right.
That, with that cash. Okay, right. Well, let's move on to Crest Nicholson. I said we're not going to talk about Brexit, but I mean, there may be some Brexit interference on sentiment for that stock. But, you know, it's this sort of Rick gets alarm bells ringing. I guess, you know, we appoint you as a manager to, you know, take the some of the controversial decisions that we're not brave enough to make. But, you know, Crest sort of finds itself in that sort of pinch point between, you know, it's a higher price point housing, isn't it? So it's not really going to capture any help to buy. Perhaps those downsizing are finding a bit of an obstacle because of stamp duty. You know, those are the sort of classic, you know, observable risks, but you've decided to go in. You know, tell us a bit more why.
Yeah, so it was a new addition to the portfolio during the month of October. And, you know, during that month, it definitely had to own up with regards to some of its current trading. Crest behind Berkeley Group would want to be one of the more exposed companies to London, and definitely the price point above £600,000 is very difficult. Help to buy is clearly a very helpful tailwind below that level. And I think pleasingly during the month, you know, Help to Buy has been extended to 2023, so I think we have reasonable visibility around that going forward. Specifically with Crest, I think the profit warning was quite significant, and a couple of things happened there. Firstly, actually, we welcome a returning of Mr. Stone to the business. He was an individual who was potentially on his way out, but as I say, he's sort of the travails that the business has come under. He's very definitely keen to get a bit more on board in operations. The strategy, I think, has become more circumspect. But crucially, and as with all these things, I think, you know, the big risk mitigator in everything, to some extent in our view, would be valuation. And the shares corrected quite materially below book value. We have to remember the history of this company, and it did end up in the bank's hands during the crisis. So it was actually one of the few house builders that actually did write down its asset value during the financial crisis. So I think as we look at the asset value in the business, we think it's actually been, you know, very definitely written down, whereas others haven't. I think to get the shares in the sort of depths of October at about a 20% discount to that asset value, I think was a great opportunity. With regards to the more circumspect strategy that we have going forward, I think that will go hand in hand with more cash flow. And from our perspective, therefore, you know, we're very, very reticent to pass up on opportunities in the house building sector below book that are cash backed. The rest of the sector trades at a small premium. This to us looked like an outlier. And from that perspective, we're happy to rotate out of our Barratt Developments, which has actually been a very good, you know, good share for the fund since about March. Also paid us huge amount of dividend last month as well. From that perspective, it seemed an eminently sensible sort of switch in the fund to move out of Barratt Development, which had probably been up on a six-month view, and to rotate into Crest, which has fallen by the best part of a third.
Okay, so tell us a little bit more about that strategy. I mean, is it sort of looking to rotate away or dilute some of its London exposure? What's it doing in terms of its land banks? I mean, is it sort of aggressively building? Is it, what's it doing with its balance sheet?
Well, it's still a situation whereby it needs to get rid of the last of its London exposure. It is definitely more of a southeast footprint, but I think if you can move out of the expensive areas of London, actually, I still think the southeast is an attractive footprint for it to own. It will not alter that footprint hugely at all. I think with regards to its strategy going forward, it'll be more circumspect when it comes to land buying, no doubt. This will give rise, I think, to slightly, you know, superior cash flows going forward. And I say, from our perspective, with process in mind, if we can just keep exposing ourselves to businesses below book that continue to generate cash from a starting point of net cash, you know, statistically for us, the odds feel very definitely on our side, really making, you know, making very, very attractive returns going forward. The shares have actually pleasingly, you know, moved quite well from below the £3 level. Today they're at about £3.50. But as I say, from our perspective, as I say, that was just too good an opportunity to pass up. And as I say, I felt we were reasonably measured within the sector context, making sure we're rotating out of those companies that maybe have done quite a bit relatively better into areas that have done quite a bit worse.
So it's not a big sector call on house builders. Yeah. This is more of a sort of an isolated opportunity.
Absolutely. Isolated opportunity, I think, on a sort of confluence of events. As I said, big opportunity below book value and very definitely funded from other areas of the portfolio which have done quite a bit better within the same sector.
Okay, well, we'll keep moving through and then we'll move on to IAG. Again, I guess we'll sort of ask you to lay out the bull case and then we'll see if we can unpick it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So IAG, again, another addition to the fund in October, has been quite weak. You know, shares have been, you know, nearer £7 recently. Shares got well below £6 during the month. With IAG, I think there are a few concerns. Clearly, there will always be cyclical concerns with the business, and we've got IAG currently making peak margins, so about 15%, and that will always linger in people's minds, because if you go back and look at the 2006-2007 cycle, margins couldn't get above 10%. Again, we had margins just into double digits in the late 90s, so 15% margins is unusual. So I think that will always give some sort of reticence to investors with regards to the multiple that we want to attach to IAG. But during the month, IAG fell to about 5x earnings. It also started to get propped up by book value. So you can look at IAG on a sort of fleet basis, and you start, and you can very definitely compare that across the international airline space with regards to that as a sort of quasi-asset value. So we started to get valuation trigger on a number of measures, definitely earnings-based and also asset-based. The thing, one thing we need to be a little bit more careful about is clearly the business is potentially, going to possibly buy Norwegian, which I think is, we very definitely understand that from a strategic perspective and a capacity perspective. But as I say, that would be probably the one fly in the ointment for us at the moment that wouldn't encourage us to have more than we do. We started with a 1% position across the funds during the month of October. And again, with valuation in mind, and I think this is something we see a lot across the whole market actually, is that we just see a big discount emerging in a lot of the UK names relative to international peers. So I'm not saying, again, it's an absolute perfect lookalike of businesses in America, such as Delta, for example, but very, very unusual to get IAG at this level of discount relative to the US carriers, you know, those transatlantic carriers. So to put into perspective, IAG in the sort of realms of 5 to 5.5x earnings, and US peers nearer 9x earnings. So a bit of a valuation disconnect there. And then also, we've seen a little bit of a change of trend in the oil market. Clearly, it can change very, very quickly indeed. But just to put it into context, the fuel bill at IAG is in the realms of sort of 6 billion euros, profits in the realms of 3 billion euros. So clearly, from a sort of near-term perspective, as the hedges start to roll off looking into next year, potentially it's also a reasonably helpful tailwind to earnings. And I think the final point to make is there has been a bit of capacity coming out. So we've definitely seen some corporate failure in Europe with regards to capacity coming out. And I think, therefore, if you piece together the valuation, the capacity trends that we think are getting much more moderate going forward, and also, as I say, a slightly helpful tailwind potentially starting to merge in oil, then I think from our perspective, again, that would be a share starting for the valuation it is, that we would hopefully see the valuation hopefully creeping higher rather than lower.
That's a very sort of thorough, well put together case. And I guess the risks I would sort of present to that, you would say, would be sort of nicely priced or would be reasonably priced in. And I guess these risks are nothing new. You sort of look at sort of the transatlantic route, you're understanding that's sort of the big profit area. That's pretty competitive. Think about you. It's interesting what you say about Europe in the consolidation. You know, you can tell us more about that, but it's not obvious that these sort of discount airlines aren't, you know, running away with it. And then you look at the Asian connections, and that looks as though, you know, you have some sort of sovereign, sovereign wealth funds behind them. So all of that makes it sort of quite difficult to be competitive in those markets. All of that looks, paints a sort of a rather challenging picture for IAG.
Okay, interesting. I mean, I think we would very definitely look at a couple of corporate failures in Europe, which I think should talk to a more measured capacity growth. We can also actually look at what's happening with regards to peers in the space and their capex intention. And again, they've been moderately reined back. And I always think, as I say, if you just start to get the inflection in the supply sides, you know, the demand side will always fluctuate. But we very definitely feel as managers that we should be able to get supply sides of industries right. And where we see the pressures on supply easing, that's to say less competition coming in, at this type of valuation, as I say, I think we've got a situation whereby there's a very reasonable margin of safety, both its starting valuation on the earnings and also asset-backed. And as I say, if we're going to start to see a couple of things going our way with regards to capacity and maybe also the oil price, then I think actually we could see a slightly better year ahead for the shares.
It does have a very sort of complicated cost structure in relation to sort of staffing, doesn't it? I mean, is that, do you think those sort of troubles are at all behind it, or?
I think with regards to the cost, clearly the business undertook merger with Iberia. Interesting, as you benchmark those two businesses in their old form, so British Airways and Iberia, it was actually to some extent Iberia had the better cost structure. So it was actually a very interesting exercise for the company to do as they benchmarked their maintenance, some of their labour practices. So it was Iberia that had the better practices. So I think, if you like, that sort of dragged IAG up with regards to potentially some of its costs, its cost disciplines that it needed to improve. And then with regards to unions, thankfully, clearly the union pressure has been felt elsewhere in the sector, not necessarily IAG. But I think there was going to be a period where I think the unions could put them under a bit more pressure than this would have been it. But I think they've got through that period well. I think there's a good cost story going as two businesses tend to come together. So as I say, if you look at mergers of businesses and you look at mergers of all sorts of industries over long periods of time, it usually tends to give rise to a very good cost opportunity. And I don't think we'd see any different opportunity here in IAG with regards to the cost it can go after. And as I say, we think there are one or two tailwinds with regards to capacity and oil going forward as well.
But you think a purchase of Norwegian would not be the right strategic move for the
business? I think that would make me think again. As I say, just in the month we just we went to slightly less than 1% across the funds. That was a purchase slightly below £6. I think on balance, I would probably prefer the Norwegian transaction not to go ahead, I have to be honest. There have been all sorts of emotions, I think, in the last 6 months with Norwegian. When they announced the deal, the shares were £6. The market was, initially cheered them on, and the shares got to nearer £7. I think as a cautious individual, which I genuinely am with regards to balance sheets and, the amount of money that I want to see spent in debt on acquisitions and the like, I probably would be in the camp where I'd rather they did not go ahead with Norwegian.
Okay, all right, great. Well, we'll move on to our final company before you can tell us exactly where markets are going into year end. We'll look at HSBC. Now, you have a couple of mandates. One of them is an income mandate, and you've opted for some preference shares in that business, which offer a decent income. You can tell us more about that, but I guess our starting concern is that not all preference shares or these sort of quasi bond equity assets are created equal, and the covenants or the litigation underlying or the legalities underlying each actually quite difficult to untangle, and we don't quite know where we sit. But presumably you've done all that work on the one that you're looking at and the one that you're in.
Yeah, so I think, so just with regards to bonds, this very definitely made its, this instrument has made its way into the income fund. With the income fund in mind, the strategy is three-pronged. It is our existing value strategy where the yields at least that of the wider market. We then have a strand of the process that absolutely dedicated to isolating dividend surprise through a focus on superior free cash flow and balance sheets. And then the third strand is the bond portion of the portfolio. And our checklist to be invested in bonds is threefold. There must be a listed equity that we can analyse. We must think there is equity value in that equity. And then we must be able to express that in a manner whereby we can get both capital upside and also an attractive running yield, which will be, part and parcel of buying, attractively sized coupons at a discount to par. So specifically here in the bond market, we've been probably quiet in the bond market in the income fund, really. If I go back to Q1, Q2 2016, that was a moment where quite a bit of oil debt entered the fund. So, names such as Tullow Oil, for example, we had the opportunity to buy their debt at sort of 65, 70p in the pound. But the bond market this year has started to get much more interesting to us. And the episodes there, I think, have been threefold. I think rate rises at the start of the year in Q1. I think we've then seen issues around Italy. And then also, I think there's been quite a well-documented sort of selling pressure in the space because of fund liquidations. And that's really driven a lot of bonds from a premium to par. So to give you the sort of trading history of the bond that we bought within the HSBC capital structure, issued at 100, they were trading at as high as 106 towards the end of last year, and now have the opportunity to visit them at 92. You're absolutely right, this is perpetual bond. So you are down, if you like, the bond structure, but you'll always be senior to equity. There will be triggers whereby this bond will become equity, but I think, again, you feel you will rank above the equity. No doubt. And simplistically, the triggers are in place in a lot of these instruments is that capital ratios need to halve from here and actually stay there for an extended period of time. So you'd need the equity market not to be willing to fund these businesses under that scenario, which is clearly a possibility. But I think with regards to capital ratios halving, you can go and simulate again the financial crisis there, and those capital ratios, I think, would not come under that amount of pressure that would trigger these events. So it just looks to us a confluence of events that have driven some really attractive opportunities in the bond market, whereby bond prices have probably fallen by the best part of 15%. As I say, in this instance, the running yield is on the bond is slightly over 7%. It is callable, and should interest rates in America not pierce that 5, 6% level, which I think probably looks unlikely, then this is very definitely an instrument whereby the bank would probably look to call that in due course, because it would clearly be a situation whereby they could probably fund it cheaper elsewhere.
Okay, so it is an asset that clearly offers a nice amount of income, and there is a cushion there, a really healthy cushion, before it could get converted into a more challenged asset. But do you have to look at the sort of operations of HSBC and sort of call that as being in good stead, or is that cushion enough?
Yeah, I think we've seen so recent results from HSBC. I think have been, you know, clearly it's an enormously large company.
Yeah, sure.
Recent performance.
Pretty complicated.
Clearly. I mean, I think there's, you know, with banks, you know, they are clearly still levered to the tune of about 15 to, you know, 20 times levered. But with regards to recent results we've seen from the company, very much better. I think they've got the real cost headwinds they had behind, which were really troubling the business 2 to 3 years ago. I also hugely applaud the strategy over the last 3 or 4 years to simplify the business. And broadly speaking, we've got to remember where that company was 3 or 4 years ago. You know, it was clearly not in investors' good books. But what they did is they streamlined the business. They moved from non-core areas such as Turkey and Brazil, which look very sensible now. They moved on from those areas and they returned to their really strong core banking franchises. That process released capital, simplified the business, and actually I think we see the financial performance coming from still clearly a hugely sort of international bank, but I think a much more streamlined bank has been much improved in recent years.
Okay, right. Well, that's really helpful to get all those views on those businesses. I guess we sort of round out now with an unfair question about sort of market dynamics. Like I said, this Brexit meeting's going on, but if we were to sort of pose a hypothetical to you that the UK sort of avoids a disorderly no-deal Brexit scenario. You know, how does the UK market stack up? No doubt you'll feel pretty optimistic about your portfolios and your funds. You can certainly reference that. But the market at large would be interested to know whether you think this sort of stacks up as a decent opportunity. And you can certainly draw in, you know, other factors, you know, whether they think, you know, an emerging markets, a Chinese slowdown or US recession are at all likely and may derail any bullish thesis.
Absolutely. If we look at the UK versus, you know, world markets, so probably if you could look at the FTSE All Share relative to the FTSE World, we find ourselves at an unusual discount, so about a 15% discount, which probably puts it in the sort of the best 10% of opportunities that we've seen over a number of years. Now, I think clearly Brexit is playing into that discount that we see. If you rewind back to the start of 2016, the UK market was actually at about a 5% premium to the FTSE World. At that point in time, we were one of the faster growers within the G7, for example, and investors were happy to pay that premium. Now, clearly, actually, growth is not too bad. I think recent growth has been better, moving in the right direction in the league tables versus the G7, for example. But clearly, I think Brexit definitely affects sentiment. And from that, that's definitely vesting itself in valuation, which looks, as I say, stretched to the downside relative to international markets. And then also, again, maybe building on earlier comments, we'd look at a lot of UK international-focused businesses that do just look unusually cheap versus their international peers. I'm not saying international peers are always a perfect fit for businesses, but I think they definitely give you a guide. And as I say, we look at valuation being stretched to the downside definitely there. What would happen if there was ever anything, you know, achieved that would be constructive on Brexit? I think clearly it would feel that, you know, sterling maybe would be to some extent higher. Numerically, to some extent, that plays against the UK market. Clearly, the 70% of overseas earnings numerically would, you know, be less valuable under a rising sterling. But I think there would be room for the UK market to re-rate. You know, so we look at the UK market less than 12 times now. I think we would definitely, I think, be in a situation whereby hopefully PE point or two could be added to that. So I think we can see a situation whereby, notwithstanding the fact there would be currency-related downgrades under, you know, perversely a satisfactory Brexit outcome, but there is room in valuation, I think, to move higher. But clearly the skew of the market there, I think, would be led by domestic. So I think, you know, it would be house builders, real estate perhaps, also banks, I think, which do, again, all look unusually cheap versus international peers.
Okay, I guess you'd be making those moves as appropriate, as the news, as the story, as events require.
Yeah, look, you're going to have to be unbelievably sort of, I think, active, nimble, very, very prepared to change your mind as and when facts change. But as I say, from our perspective, we're very clear where we try to tilt the portfolio within our rules. And as I say, we will just absolutely adhere to the rules which we, you know, hold most dear to heart with regards to allocating capital, which is the best value opportunities complemented by the best estimates momentum and some of the best cash flows.
Okay, great. Well, thanks so much, Henry, for sparing the time and sharing your thoughts on the market, but most particularly, you know, giving us such insights into those businesses that you hold and why, and not shying away from some of the more controversial stocks. To our listeners, thanks very much for listening. Let us know what you think on Twitter, referencing hashtag Brewing Podcast, or leave a review on iTunes or whatever platform you listen to this podcast from. Let us know what you think. But until next time, many thanks for listening.